I think it is a really intimidating book, partly because of its size and it's the Russian quality of it, but and I think also because it figures so often in popular culture as an icon of a book that it's impossible to read, sort of like The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which everybody has on the shelf but nobody reads. But it really is not a history book. It's not a daunting book at all. It's a fantastic book. And very gripping, very vivid, very vital, and in many ways very contemporary. I think the size, this edition that we've done with Oxford University Press has completely minimized that aspect of it. I mean, you won't get hammer thumb or tendonitis from handling the paperback book. I've never seen this novel so miraculously compressed before. It's really wonderful. And then the Russian names have all been clearly explained. So there's really no existential reason to feel that this novel is too much for anyone to read. And I think if you pick it up and start reading it, you'll be engrossed immediately. And it will repay every minute of reading time. It's an absolutely exciting and dynamic novel about people. It's not really a history book at all. Tolstoy, in his account of the writing process, described himself as being at the height of his powers, and he felt very good about himself and what he was doing, and he realized that he was tackling a momentous and new kind of idea for a novel, which he actually then later decided it wasn't a novel at all. He had a wife who, and I think for some of us, that's almost the more interesting part of it, because she served as his secretary and copied the novel out by hand 7 times. That's daunting. Mm. While she was pregnant and nursing babies and running the household, she bounced ideas around with him. It was almost really a collaborative project. And I think that's partly why the novel feels very human and real, and why the domestic scenes or the intimate scenes are stunning for the 19th century in what they show about real life. They don't have that sort of conventional style of romance that you might encounter in a Victorian novel, but they seem almost documentary, like somebody's got a camera into somebody's private home. That was something new for Tolstoy. I think the subject matter, the Napoleonic War, this had been written about in European literature and English literature. There's Thackeray's Vanity Fair and Hugo's Les Misérables. And what we probably do need to understand is that for writers of the mid-19th century, the Napoleonic War was the last event of global import that affected people throughout the reading world of Europe. It's similar in a way to World War II for our imagination. So this was a war that figured very high in the popular imagination. And how to describe it, how to tackle it, was something that created mammoth novels on the continent and in England. Those books about the Napoleonic War tend to be huge. It's a huge subject matter. It's almost inexhaustible. So when Tolstoy sat down to his task, he knew that he was up against monuments in the literary tradition. He also was fairly new to the literary scene himself. He had a great deal of success, but he was by no means considered the greatest writer alive. I think Turgenev probably had that reputation rather than Tolstoy at this point. He also had, as most of the Russian writers did, a certain inferiority complex vis-a-vis European or English literature, because Russia, sort of like America, was late to the literary scene and didn't have a great tradition of chivalric literature, no Renaissance to speak of, not even really a neoclassical or Baroque literary tradition. They came fresh from the egg into the 19th century, contending with Romantic realism, kind of all bundled together. So Tolstoy felt that he was doing several things. He was trying to write the ultimate Russian novel. He was trying to, perhaps, I think he knew he was probably writing the greatest novel to appear in print. And he was also trying to establish himself. So he wanted everything to be in this work. He wanted it to be large and small at the same time. And he struggled mightily with the question of an artistic design that would be innovative and do what he wanted and still address all of his anxieties of influence. And I think the stroke of genius that came to him was to realize that the absence of a design was itself the design. Well, I think when he arrived at the conception that the lack of a design could be his design, he could point to a precedent in Russian letters for being unusual, quirky, anomalous, disingenuous. He had the father of Russian literature, the great poet Alexander Pushkin, whose famous novel, Eugene Onegin, was a novel in verse. That was a departure from standards. One wouldn't necessarily consider that a novel. And then there was Gogol, whose Dead Souls was subtitled a poema or an epic. So even though that was a novel, it wasn't really a novel. It was more Dante-esque. So Tolstoy was able to climb in on that bandwagon. I think one reason Turgenev was recognized more widely in Europe is that his writing was more conventional. He wrote novella and novels that were very similar to the types of things you would read on the continent or in England, whereas the rest of the Russian writers were doing rather bizarre, both stylistically, formally, and in terms of plot. When you have Gogol writing about noses that depart from people's faces and wander through the streets of Petersburg. There was also a sense in Russian letters of a fantastic element that's a little bit different from the European Gothic. And I think Tolstoy taps that as well. His novel, War and Peace, at moments definitely takes off from the realistic and goes into psychological realms and transcendental moments. So in all of these ways, I think he had a tradition he could lean on when he said that he was going to do something radical. It did not have a resounding standing ovation when the first episodes came out. And it came out in installments. It's important to understand that. I've always tried to imagine what the typical Russian reader, Russian landlord, landlocked in the middle of nowhere with piles of snow and mud all around in his estate in the depths of the Russian countryside would have felt when he opened his latest journal and found the first installment of War and Peace and the first installment of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. That, I mean, what a thing to sit down and read after dinner. But the novel being rather formless and having such an enormous cast of characters was confusing to the critics who complained that they couldn't discern who the main characters were, that they couldn't tell where the work was going. The title of the original installment was 1805, not War and Peace. There was no super title. There was no sense of where the work was going. It didn't seem to follow standard plot structures. It jumped right in media res with people at a party talking in a very superficial way about events in recent history. So there were no introductory chapters about our hero, our heroine, who they were, where they came from. There was nothing to give the reader a sense of direction or focus. It was admired. I think everybody was excited by it, but it still presented itself as something that could be criticized. And as the work continued to appear and gained momentum, I think that there was an increased recognition that something really great was unfolding. And by the end of the century, it had attained the canonical status it has now as the greatest work ever written. He originally started writing a history of the Decembrist Revolution, and his characters were a Decembrist who had taken part in the revolution, been exiled to Siberia, and was now returning home to Russia with his wife and old man. And as he continued his research, Tolstoy realized that to understand what had happened with the Decembrist Revolution, he had to look farther back. And the farther back he went, the more involved his search came. I know anybody who's done historical research will have the same experience. This research process for Tolstoy was very similar to his overarching concerns with narrative itself. The first story that he wrote was called A History of Yesterday, in which he tried to go into each moment as it unfolded sort of in a space beyond time, in the minds of the characters, in the many, many repercussions of what happened in a second of thought, a glance, a movement, to come up with the conclusion that it was impossible to recount what had happened yesterday. So this was sort of a theme for Tolstoy throughout his life, and I think encountering it in historical narrative enabled him to come up with the idea of the impossibility of relating history accurately or any event accurately. We see that in the course of the novel when soldiers come out of the battlefield and then they recraft their chaotic and wild and incomprehensible experience into a soldier's tale of glory, which more experienced soldiers tend to shoot down. They say, we know this isn't really what happened, but they don't know what really happened either. So this is why the novel took on its formless, chaotic, complex confused, shapeless form. The role of the French in the novel is very important because the novel is about the French invasion of Moscow, and the invasion takes place in the narrative, as I've mentioned, but it also takes place inside the characters' psyches, and the characters themselves can be broken down into those characters who have been adversely corrupted by French morals, manners, ideas, and then the true Russian characters. It's a little bit schematic, but it's in the novel. And on another level, which is somewhat unprecedented, I think, in world literature, there's a kind of linguistic warfare between the French language and the Russian language that takes place in the novel. So literary critics might talk about macaronic language, where there are several languages all scrambled together, and that is what happens in this book. Now, the Mauds, who are, I think, universally recognized as the greatest translators of War and Peace, and who did for Oxford Press on the last centennial of Tolstoy's birth, a complete multi-volume set of all of Tolstoy's writings. When they came to do War and Peace, they feeling as we all do that it needs a little bit of opening up to make it more accessible, so they turned Russian names into English names so that we have Andrew instead of Andrei or Peter instead of Pyotr. And they also translated all of the French. And there is also some German, Italian, Latin sprinkled around. They translated that all into English for the most part. And if a character was going to be speaking in French, they might do something like start his speech off with a few French words, et bien, and then on into English. So I think by this point in time, in the 21st century, most of us felt that the newer translations, because they contained the French, might be a better way to go in order to really feel the novel as it was meant to be. But none of those newer translations, good though they may be, are really as magnificent as what the Mauds were able to accomplish in their version. So it seemed that rather than produce yet another new translation, why not take what is still considered to be the definitive and best translation of this work and make those small changes that were necessary to bring it closer to the original text by bringing back the original French and putting the names back as Russian names. That's what we've done, and I think it makes the Mauds everything it ought to have been and absolutely a perfect read of this book. Yes, it was morning, and it was also early hours of the morning. It was a very extended labor, and I often thought about Tolstoy's wife copying it by hand. I had a computer, and it took a lot of time. First, I went over the translation with the Russian very closely to try to pick up any errors, because there were a few here or there, minor things that needed correcting. And then I went over the English, trying to distance myself from the Russian, looking for those points where occasionally there were creaky Victorianisms that dated the translation a little bit. This didn't often happen, but they were in there. I think that when the Mauds worked together, Almer, the husband, tended to do the philosophical passages, the war scenes, and the descriptive passages, and then when it came to drawing room or romantic moments, he tended to turn that over to his wife. And her style was a little bit Victorian women's magazine. So I tried to adjust that. And then there were points where foot soldiers were speaking in the same kind of style as an officer, even though in Tolstoy's version they sounded like peasants. So I would adjust that back as well. Then I took all of the French from the original Russian and put it back into the text. I retained the Mauds translation of the French for the most part and edited it where it was necessary. There's sort of an expression about translation is like kissing a woman through a veil. It's true that a translation often impedes rather than facilitates our appreciation, and we all want to read things in the original if we really want to read something. But I also think that there have occasionally been times where translations themselves have almost the same artistic status as the original work. I could think of the translation of Proust or Dryden's translation of Homer. I mean, every now and then you get something that's really worthy in its own right, and I think the Mauds translation of War and Peace is one of those achievements. That's really interesting, because I've taught this book many times, and I've read it. I've lost track how many times, and I've combed over it with my computer for a year, almost every day, for several hours a day. And yet, when I come at it, one of the reasons that it took so long to do the revisions is every single time when I came to certain scenes, I was so moved that there were tears in my eyes, and I had to stop working. And each time through, I would say, surely not this time. You know, surely I'm immune to it by now, but I never could lose. Tolstoy is such a great genius that it still evokes the same response as the first time I read it. When I was in high school, and in my high school, for some reason at that time, all the cool kids read Russian literature. So that's what I was doing, and I guess I was about 14, and I started reading War and Peace, and I was told by my parents that I had to read the Maud translation, and possibly that inculcated in me some sort of awe for the Maud. But when I started reading it, there was actually an earthquake in my town, so I always associate that moment in my life is somehow apocalyptic. And as the years went on, and I didn't know Russian then, but it inspired me to take Russian in school. As the years went on, and the more I became a Tolstoy scholar and focused on Tolstoy, the more I had a sense that I really wanted to see the Maud translation restored in this way. And I used to think, but I can't be the one to do it because my initials are the same as Almer Maud's. How will we ever distinguish in the footnotes between an A and an AM? And the press editor, Judith Luna, and I did have some discussion. Well, what if we put mine in square brackets and his in parentheses? But I feel that it was, in a way, something that I always wanted to do. And I was very, very happy to have the chance to do it.